Last fall, you might have heard the news about a disturbing case out of New York. Here's a clip from CBS New York.
An 18-year-old says that she was raped in a police department van after two detectives took her into custody. CBS 2's Andrea Grimes spoke with the accuser's attorney and has the story.
She's an emotional wreck.
Michael David says his 18-year-old client is beside herself, claiming she was raped in handcuffs by a plainclothes NYPD detective.
There was nothing she could do to defend herself.
What followed was even more disturbing. In February 2018, BuzzFeed News published an article that featured a map of the United States and the headline, "A Nationwide Problem. Laws in 35 states allow cops to have sex with someone in their custody." The article was shared across social media and led many to wonder whether it could possibly be true. So what's going on here, and how can you help change your state's law? You'll find out in today's special episode, Consent.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. This is a special bonus episode all about detainee consent. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the book A Non-Story, and I'm here with my colleague Colin Miller.
I'm Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. But they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. With results like that, it's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is the highest rated hiring site in America. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. That's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter.com/UNDISCLOSED. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Now, when a defendant is charged with a sex crime, he can claim as defense that the victim consented. Of course, the huge unanswered question that states continue to grapple with is what exactly constitutes consent? Most recently, Montana updated its rape law last year to modify its definition of consent. Here's a clip from KPAX TV.
Before, without consent was force or a victim who was in a position of being incapable of giving consent because of age or because of extreme intoxication or physical helplessness, being asleep, being unconscious, those things. What those statutes didn't catch, of course, were the victims who were freezing and not saying really yes or no. And offenders take advantage of that.
As of October 1st, Montana law changed the definition of consent to have sex. The presence of yes, physically or verbally, is now required to have consensual sex. And the absence of no doesn't mean that the person wants to have sex. That's a big change from when the old law was written, which didn't take into account new information about how victims respond during and after an assault or any unwanted sexual contact.
Montana's new law focuses on when there is consent by a person who is capable of giving consent. But what about the other side of the equation? Specifically, what's the history of laws classifying certain categories of people as being incapable of giving consent?
You're probably most familiar with statutory rape or age of consent laws. These laws state that individuals below a certain age are statutorily incapable of consenting to sexual acts. Back in the colonial days, when these laws were first created, the age of consent was typically set at 10 or 12. These laws were property-based. A woman's chastity was seen as a commodity, and these laws were directed at preserving this commodity. And because this is a property-based concept, African-American women who were slaves were not protected by these laws. By the turn of the 20th century, most states raised their age of consent to between 16 and 18. And as of 2017, about 20 states set the age of consent at 16, while about 30 states set the age of consent at 17 or 18. And as of 2017, there was no clear age of consent for federal sex crimes, prompting the Supreme Court's opinion in Esquivel-Quintana v. Sessions. In that case, a lawful permanent resident from Mexico pleaded no contest to statutory rape under California law, where the age of consent is 17. Under the Immigration and Nationality Act, the defendant was subject to deportation if he was guilty of sex abuse of a minor under federal law, which does not state an age of consent. In a unanimous opinion, the Supreme Court determined a federal age of consent. Here's Justice Thomas announcing the opinion of the court.
We hold that in the context of statutory rape offenses that criminalize sexual intercourse based solely on the age of the participants, the federal definition of sexual abuse of a minor requires that the victim be younger than 16. Because the California statute at issue in this case sets an age of consent older than 16, a conviction under that statute does not qualify as sexual abuse of a minor.
In the 1970s, many states all started adding age differential or Romeo and Juliet provisions to their statutory rape laws. For example, Missouri defines second-degree statutory rape as someone at least age 21 having sexual intercourse with someone who is less than age 17. So while 17 is the age of consent in Missouri, it's not statutory rape for, say, a 19 or 20-year-old to engage in sexual relations with a 16-year-old. Now, interestingly, as of 1981, about 13 states had gendered statutory rape laws. These stated that sexual acts with a minor female was statutory rape, but that sexual acts with a minor male was not. One of these states was California, and the Supreme Court addressed California's law in the Michael M. case in 1981. Here's Justice Rehnquist announcing why this law didn't violate equal protection.
Not all laws which draw distinctions on the basis of sex are unconstitutional. The California statutory rape law is designed to protect young women from the harmful effects of consequences of teenage pregnancy by prohibiting males from having sexual intercourse with young females. We reject petitioner's contention that the Constitution requires a state to make young women as criminally liable as young men for the same conduct. Women suffer disproportionately the consequences of teenage pregnancy, and the state may constitutionally punish only males because they suffer few of the consequences of their acts.
Since the Michael M. opinion, however, each of the 13 outlier states, including California, have changed their statutory rape laws to make them gender neutral. Until recently, every state also had gender neutral laws allowing for underage individuals to get married, sometimes with and sometimes without parental consent. But it's primarily underage women who are getting married, and just last month, Delaware became the first state to ban child marriages.
The state's governor signed a bill Wednesday making it illegal for anyone under the age of 18 to get married there. Under the state's previous law, minors could get married at any age as long as a judge approved the marriage. According to a Frontline investigation, between 2000 and 2015, more than 200,000 minors were married in America. Nearly 90% of the minors in those underage marriages were girls. The U.S. is one of a number of countries in which the United Nations wants to see the end of child marriage by 2030.
A quote by Republican State Senator Anthony Del Colo, who supported Delaware's bipartisan bill, helps explain why the UN wants the U.S. to ban child marriage. According to Del Colo, quote, "The law, up until the passage of this measure, included an exception for circumstances that would otherwise be considered statutory rape. This bill would eliminate this backward and what I consider unacceptable exception." Specifically, while the age of consent in Delaware is 18, underage individuals used to be able to get married at age 16 or 17 and consent to sexual acts with their spouses. Under Delaware's new law, this loophole is closed.
This then takes us to the loophole that we are addressing in this episode. And to explore this loophole, we need to start by looking at the history of women in prison. Throughout this country's history, men were traditionally prohibited from serving as correctional officers in women's prisons. And throughout that history, there were low reported rates of women being sexually assaulted by female correctional officers. Next, fast forward to 1964, when this country passed one of its most sweeping civil rights laws.
Congress passes the most sweeping civil rights bill ever to be written into the law, and thus reaffirms the conception of equality for all men that began with Lincoln and the Civil War 100 years ago. The Negro won his freedom then. He wins his dignity now. 5 hours after the House passes the measure, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is signed at the White House by President Johnson. Before an audience of legislators and civil rights leaders who had labored long and hard for passage of the bill, President Johnson calls for all Americans to back what he calls a turning point in history.
One key component of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is Title VII, which prohibits employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin. Before this law, just as male correctional officers weren't typically allowed in women's prisons, female COs weren't usually allowed in men's prisons. But with the passage of Title VII, many female COs brought lawsuits claiming that laws preventing them from serving in male prisons violated Title VII's prohibition on discrimination in employment. This led to female COs being allowed to serve in male prisons, and then, of course, male COs being able to serve in women's prisons. About 41% of correctional officers in women's state prisons are now male. And this increase correlates with a stark increase in the number of sexual assaults reported by female inmates. This makes sense, given that 98% of staff on inmate sexual assaults that are reported in women's prisons involve male correctional officers. Here's a clip from the David Parkman Show talking about sexual offenses against female inmates at a women's prison in Alabama.
Female inmates at an Alabama prison say they have been raped by guards and forced to take part in strip shows and also go to the bathroom in front of guards. This is being reported in the Daily Mail. Inmates at an Alabama women's prison appear to have been raped, sodomized, and sexually abused by guards, and in some instances, allegedly forced to perform sex acts to obtain basic sanitary supplies, according to a United States Department of Justice report. The women at Tutwiler universally fear for their safety. That's what's written in the report. Around a third of employees at Tutwiler have had sex with female inmates, according to the report. The report found that the allegations of sex abuse are grossly underreported because of the fear of retaliation. Roughly a quarter of the population of the inmate population reported sexual harassment, dehumanizing behavior, excessive use of force, and inadequate medical care.
Parkman is referring to a study by the DOJ's Bureau of Justice Statistics in 2014. It found that, quote, females account for 7% of sentenced prison inmates, but represent 33% of all victims of staff on inmate sexual victimization in federal and state prisons. Similarly, females represent only 13% of inmates in local jails, but 67% of all victims of staff on inmate victimization. Now, overall, studies have found that 41% of women experience sexual victimization by a correctional officer in prison. And this very likely actually gives us an incomplete picture. That's because there's a universal belief that sexual misconduct by COs is underreported based on factors such as fear of retaliation, the absence of basic confidentiality standards within detention facilities, inadequate grievance procedures, and a lack of access to effective legal remedies. In terms of remedies, the DOJ statistics study reported that only 10% of sexual misconduct allegations in prison and jail are substantiated. Now, this isn't saying that 90% of those allegations are found to be false. There are three categories of sexual misconduct allegations in prisons. One, substantiated, meaning they were proven to be true. Two, unsubstantiated, meaning there was insufficient evidence to prove or disprove the allegation. And three, unfounded, meaning they were proven to be false. The vast majority of allegations of sexual abuse by COs are unsubstantiated, illustrating the difficulty that inmates have in proving their cases.
The Last Defense is an ABC Original 7-episode docuseries that I can't wait to watch. It will explore and expose the flaws of the American justice system through an emotional in-depth examination of the death row case of Darlie Routier, a young mother accused of murdering her two sons. From executive producer, Academy Award winner, and How to Get Away with Murder star Viola Davis, the show will thoroughly examine the evidence that led a young mother to be convicted and sentenced to death row, and bring social consciousness to what can happen to those incarcerated or potentially wrongfully incarcerated. The show gives the story a face, a heart, and a voice, and digs deep to weigh both sides of each case. The Last Defense is thought-provoking, shocking, high-stakes, real drama that will give viewers the chance to take a thorough look in this case and draw their own conclusions, while shining light in a justice system that is not always just. The Last Defense premieres Tuesday, June 12th at 10/9 Central on ABC. That's June 12th at 10/9 Central on ABC. A troubling example of this can be found in the case of Eric Melger. Here's inmate Rocio Leon talking to NJ.com about his abusive acts.
It started off with me when I first got here. He was my officer, I think my 5-day officer. So it started with little like comments and stuff. So I was like, no, shrugging it off. Oh, maybe, you know, he's just playing, whatever. Because at first he never came off as like perverted, as I may say. So I was starting to feel uncomfortable. So I always stayed to myself. And I always had a friend whose name I'm not going to mention, but she ended up getting in some trouble, ended up leaving. So when she did leave, he made a comment about, well, nobody's here to save you no more. You're by yourself. So I was like, well, what's that supposed to be? So that's how everything started, with the inappropriate comments. Then during count time, he was doing inappropriate stuff. And I was feeling very uncomfortable. I spoke to my psych about it, and she said, well, if you need help, I could help you. But I was kind of scared, because in here, it's kind of difficult, because people either don't believe your thing, well, it's your fault because you must have wanted it to happen. No, it's not that I wanted anything to happen. Like, this man is very disgusting. And I could say that I do hate him.
Leon is not alone in this hatred. According to NJ.com, quote, at least 16 women claim they were beaten or sexually abused by Melger between 2008 and 2010. And while this was enough to get Melger fired, it was not enough for criminal charges to be brought against him. The local prosecutor's office has declined to say why charges were not brought, but this seems to be a factual issue rather than a legal issue. In other words, it seems likely the prosecutor thought these women simply wouldn't be believed. And that's because the law in New Jersey is clear, like the law in many other states. An inmate cannot consent to sexual acts with a correctional officer. You can see why this would be the case. States have noted that inmates are under the dominion and control of correctional officers and are dependent upon them for care and protection. Simply put, under these circumstances, consent by inmates is a legal impossibility. And therefore, in most states, if a jury believes there was a sexual act between a correctional officer and an inmate, they must find the CO guilty of a sex crime. But there are two important caveats to this, both of them important. First, as of 2006, three states, Arizona, Delaware, and Nevada, made such sexual acts a crime not only by the CO, but also by the inmate. And as reported by Brenda Smith, in Delaware, there were instances of COs violating these laws and merely being reassigned while the inmates, quote, received both disciplinary and criminal penalties. Thankfully, Arizona and Delaware have since gotten rid of these laws, but Nevada still allows for inmates to be criminally prosecuted for sex acts with COs, which is akin to charging an underage victim with statutory rape. The second caveat deals with what happens when an inmate brings a civil claim under the Eighth Amendment against the CO who sexually assaulted her. While most states in the federal government have laws stating that inmates cannot consent to sexual acts with COs, the consent analysis in the Eighth Amendment context becomes murkier. When an inmate brings an Eighth Amendment claim based upon a CO's sexual acts, courts typically treat this as a claim of excessive force. And while a minority of courts hold that consent is not a defense to these claims, the majority of courts hold that consent can be a defense in such Eighth Amendment cases. The most infamous example can be found in the Eighth Circuit's opinion in Freitas v. Ault. The court noted in that case that an excessive force claim requires proof of, quote, unnecessary and wanton infliction of pain. And in Ault, despite finding that the CO initiated the sexual relationship with the inmate, the court concluded that, one, the CO's advances were welcomed by the inmate, and two, that, quote, welcome involuntary sexual interactions, no matter how inappropriate, cannot as a matter of law constitute pain as contemplated by the Eighth Amendment. So yeah, the law is not great with regard to inmate consent, but again, most states in the federal government do have laws that indicate that for criminal purposes, inmates can't consent to sexual acts with COs, and these COs can be prosecuted for such acts.
So this sets the stage for the case that we mentioned in the introduction. Here are additional details from CBS New York.
David says his client was driving in Calvert Vaux Park in Coney Island with two friends when two plainclothes detectives in a black van pulled them over. The detectives allegedly told the two friends to leave.
They told her to follow her, that she's under arrest, and they put handcuffs on her and they put her into the van.
David and police sources say the detectives drove her to a parking lot on Cropsey Avenue. It was here, they say, the two forced the 18-year-old to perform a sex act on both of them. David says one of the detectives then raped her. Police sources say the detectives claim the sex was consensual.
She's being brutalized twice here. First, they rape her. She's kidnapped, she's raped, and she's thrown onto the street. And then they go ahead and they victimize her again by saying it was consensual.
The case of this woman, referred to as Anna, led to the BuzzFeed story about how 35 states allow cops to have sex with someone in their custody. So let's break down what that actually means. If an officer in any state engages in non-consensual sex with somebody in his custody, he can be charged with a sex crime. The point of the article is that, at the time, in 35 states, the officer could claim that the sexual act was consensual. And what that means is this, that in many states, while an inmate cannot legally consent to sexual acts with a CO, a person in police custody could legally consent to sexual acts with a police officer. So, how often is such a consent defense successful? Buffalo News keeps a database of these types of cases, and it reports that since 2006, at least 158 law enforcement officers have been charged with sexual assault, sexual battery, or unlawful sexual contact with a person in custody. Out of these 158, 26 have been acquitted or had charges dropped against them based on a consent defense. Others were merely charged with the lesser offense of official misconduct. And while it's impossible to calculate, reporting makes clear that charges were simply never brought against many other law enforcement officers in similar situations based on the specter of such a consent defense. And so this is the loophole that gives inmates more protection, actually, than arrestees or accused. Now, even before the case out of New York, a few other states in the past decade or so have closed their loopholes. Oregon in 2005, Alaska in 2013, and Arizona in 2015. Often, these were the result of high-profile acquittals. For instance, in Arizona, a 23-year-old was arrested and handcuffed by Officer Timothy Morris on a minor misdemeanor charge, and eventually had to give him oral sex while handcuffed. She claimed this was sexual assault, and he claimed that it was consensual. Here's ABC 15 Arizona reporting on the case.
A former Phoenix police officer accused of assaulting a woman has just been found not guilty. Timothy Morris facing a kidnapping charge and two sex assault charges. He was arrested last June after a 23-year-old woman told police he had assaulted her while she was handcuffed in his custody. Now, a jury only convicting him on a misdemeanor count. That was a false reporting. So he's going to be let out of jail for time already served.
After this case, Arizona moved quickly to close its loophole, and New York did the same after Anna's case. Here's a clip from United News International.
New York State has passed a law making it illegal for police officers to have sex with people in custody. The law was passed unanimously on March 29th. It comes in the wake of a case in which two NYPD detectives are accused of raping an 18-year-old woman in the back of a police van. The detectives, who are awaiting trial, took advantage of a loophole in the law by claiming the sex was consensual and are pleading not guilty. At the time, New York outlawed sex between corrections officers and inmates, but not police officers and detainees. Because of this, consensual sex would result in no more than a charge of misdemeanor official misconduct. The new law has now closed a loophole by saying those in custody are incapable of giving consent. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo urged other states to follow New York's example.
Other states did indeed follow suit. Here's Anna Cox of the Baltimore Sun reporting on the recent legislative session in Maryland.
Leaders of both political parties, many people who watched the state house, and pundits all thought it would be pretty partisan. Lots of acrimony, not much agreement, lots of posturing. And instead, when they adjourn tonight, they're going to leave having accomplished some of the most complicated and costliest measures they've addressed in this term.
As the accompanying article notes, quote, amid the hundreds of bills approved by Maryland's legislature during its 90-day session, is one making it illegal for police officers to have sex with people in their custody. Baltimore Delegate Brooke Learman proposed a measure, which passed both the Senate and House of Delegates unanimously. After the U.S. Justice Department's investigation of the Baltimore Police Department noted complaints that officers were pressuring people in their custody for sex. Now, meanwhile, in Kansas, legislators obtained multiple affidavits that allege that Detective Roger Golobsky had a long history of coercing sex from black women in Kansas City. This led to a similar result. Here's reporting by USA Today.
A new bill in Kansas was signed into law banning police officers from having consensual sex with people in custody. According to the Wichita Eagle, before the bill was passed, Kansas was one of 33 states that did not specifically bar police officers from consensual sexual activity during the course of a traffic stop, a custodial interrogation, an interview in connection with an investigation, or while the law enforcement officer has that person detained.
Articles on the bill note that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle embraced the change, saying it was long overdue. And finally, at the end of May, the Louisiana legislature unanimously passed a similar bill. Like in other states, there seems to have been a clear impetus. This one involves Sorrento Police Chief Earl Theriau.
Chief U.S. Judge Brian Jackson sentenced former Sorrento Police Chief Earl Theriau to 24 months of probation. Now, just before handing out that sentence, he did tell Theriau that he could face anywhere between 0 to 6 months of prison time. But at the end of the day, he ended up walking away facing no prison time. Now, take a look. This is Earl Theriau walking into federal court this morning with his attorney at his side. Theriau was facing a maximum of 5 years for lying to federal authorities. He later admitted to taking a drunk woman back to his office when he was police chief and forcing her to perform sexual acts. As part of his plea deal, Theriau resigned from the force. Today in court, he apologized to just about everyone, his family and the town of Sorrento, for the embarrassment that he said he caused. He did not, however, apologize to the victim. He added that he has to carry this burden for the rest of his life. Now, Theriau was ordered to pay.
The judge's decision in this case seems odd and troubling. He gave Theriau no prison time based in part finding that Theriau showed remorse for his crime. But he focused on his own suffering and did not apologize to the victim who he claimed consented to the sexual act. Now, as a clip notes, Theriau was actually prosecuted for lying to the FBI about the incident. And additionally, the victim filed a successful civil suit against him, and the Sorrento Police Department was actually shut down in large part due to the incident. And yet, Theriau was never prosecuted for sexual assault. But now, after the Louisiana legislature unanimously passed a bill making it illegal for a law enforcement officer to have sex with someone that has been arrested or is otherwise in custody, that's one fewer roadblock to such criminal prosecutions. The truth is that most of us are brushing our teeth wrong. Either we're not doing it long enough, or we forget to change our brush on time. I mean, considering everything we're juggling in our lives, it's understandable, but yeah, I'm totally guilty of that second one. But that's also because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So what makes Quip so different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, and it still packs just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip has a built-in timer. It helps you clean your teeth for the dentist recommended 2 minutes and has guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Now, what I love Quip the best is that they have a subscription plan that are meant for your health, not just for your convenience. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5. And that includes free shipping worldwide. Finally, everybody loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O-List, they were named one of Time's best inventions, and it is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/undisclosed right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack absolutely free at getquip.com/undisclosed. Once again, that's getquip, getquip.com/undisclosed.
With these four states passing consent bills in the past few months, that leaves 31 states in which juries could find that people in custody consented to sexual acts with law enforcement. But that number may soon decrease to 30. Recently, Pennsylvania Representative Christopher Rabb introduced a bill that would eliminate the concept of detainee consent. Here's Rabb explaining the bill.
Right now in the state of Pennsylvania, it's legal for a law enforcement officer to sexually assault someone in custody and then be able to go to court and use sexual consent as a defense. That's legal. So sexual assault, of course, is not legal. But the defense, it was consensual, even though the individual was in custody. That's allowable right now. My bill would make it illegal so that if someone is in custody, police officers specifically are not allowed to engage in any sexual conduct with that person.
It's also important to note that when Rabb and other representatives speak of people in custody, they're not just talking about suspects. 16 and 17-year-olds can end up in the custody of law enforcement after a call about child abuse. And the same can happen to victims of domestic violence. And finally, victims of crimes such as rape and sexual assault are also often in the custody of law enforcement. There are individuals who, in 31 states, are legally capable of consenting to sexual acts with law enforcement officials despite being in this type of custody. And a case in South Carolina out of Orangeburg shows the problems with these types of laws. Here's a clip from WLTX.
This is about the powerful taking advantage of the powerless.
Attorney Justin Bamberg says his client was sexually assaulted by an Orangeburg deputy.
This officer took advantage of this woman, and he forced her to do something against her will under the threat of duress and arrest. And that should never happen.
The Orangeburg Sheriff's Office has not released any details, but Sheriff Leroy Ravenel did say after he heard about the allegations, he fired the deputy in question.
It's my understanding that he did not deny that a sexual act took place.
Bamberg says two deputies responded to a domestic violence call. One stayed outside with a boyfriend while the accused deputy was inside questioning the woman. She claims that deputy then forced her to perform a sex act on him while her young daughter slept in the next room.
It's even more traumatizing when the individual that does it has a badge and a uniform. And the only person that you can call for help is also someone that has a badge and a uniform.
As the woman's attorney, Justin Bamberg, would later note at a press conference, the first difficult hurdle in a case like this is the victim even coming forward with allegations.
My client has been struggling day to day to recover from the traumatic experience that she had at the hands of this officer, and we will continue seeking justice. There is a bit of joy for my client today because, as we know, in incidences such as this where there are alleged sexual assaults, many victims do not step forward, and many of those who do are not believed, and that is very traumatic. And in fact, it's our position that that is what happened in this situation early on.
And then, the second hurdle in such cases in 31 states is proving that the sexual act was not consensual. The officer in this case was Derek Johnson,
And as we can see from this clip from his preliminary hearing, his lawyer's claim is that the woman initiated the sexual act to dissuade him from arresting her boyfriend for domestic violence.
Based upon the officer's testimony, he says my client has admitted to the above crime. And again, assuming he did make a statement, he may have admitted to an act, but I don't think he admitted to a crime. In order for there to be a crime, there must be some criminal intent. And in this particular situation, what you have is an unfortunate seductress who is attempting to perform an oral act in order to convince the law enforcement officer for not doing his job. Now, be that as it may, maybe there's some assertions here as to what should and should not have happened. But that's why I've asked this officer, what is it that you're claiming that he did that amounts to a crime? I believe that there is not enough evidence to establish the basis for a criminal act because there is not enough evidence for criminal intent. Acquiescence, in my humble opinion and legal argument, does not necessarily amount to criminal intent. If you really look at this case in its true picture, the true victim in this case, arguably, is Derrick Johnson. Because Derrick Johnson is not the one who initiated the alleged act that led to the reason why he's here today.
Now, in the end, Johnson was charged and convicted, not of sexual assault, but of misconduct in office. And he wasn't given a prison term, just 3 years probation and community service. If he had been charged with sexual assault, would a consent defense have worked? It's a question we should never have to ask. Instead, crime victims and suspects in custody should be given the same protection as inmates at correctional facilities. And that's why I'm working on a bill with South Carolina law students and Mandy Powers Norell, a state representative and candidate for lieutenant governor alongside gubernatorial candidate James Smith. The bill is modeled off of the recent legislation in New York, Maryland, Kansas, and Louisiana that was all met with broad bipartisan support. We always get questions about how listeners can make a difference in the criminal justice system, and this is one primary example. If you have the time, take a look at the BuzzFeed map and see whether your state is one of the remaining states that allow for law enforcement to claim consent as a defense to a sexual act with a detainee. And if it is, give a call to your state representative and ask them to introduce a bill removing consent as a defense, letting them know that a combination of four red and blue states have recently passed similar bills to broad bipartisan support in the past 4 months. It can be tough to make change happen in the criminal context, but this is a case where everyone seems to be on the same page, and getting the ball rolling can be all it takes to help a lot of people.
A big thank you to everybody who makes Undisclosed possible. Thank you to our sponsors who help us put on our episodes week after week. Thank you to Mital Delahan, our executive producer, for helping keep this ship afloat. Thank you to Rebecca Lavoie, our fantastic audio producer, and also the co-host and producer of a couple of my favorite podcasts, including Crime Writers On. Do not miss her podcast. Thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Christy for maintaining our website. Also, a big thank you to our listeners. Thanks for coming back week after week. Check us out and make sure to follow us online on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. And please do not forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. Thanks so much. See you in a week.